We'll bring this meeting of House State Affairs to order. It is 8:02 on Thursday, April 13th, and present are Representative Elkins, Representative Gatto, Representative Gardner, Representative Seaton, and today we have three items on our agenda. If anyone is here for the presentation on the electronic voting machines, the touchpads, and the paper trail ballots, and those, that'll be next Thursday. Next Thursday, we'll start at 8 o'clock with a presentation of those voting machines, the paper trail, and explanation of how they're going to analyze those paper trails, discrepancies, at what point in discrepancies will not only a precinct, but then full district counts, and at what point will there be, you know, could even trigger statewide recounts if there's discrepancies. And so we'll get that information, and everybody can try out one of the touchpad machines and everything. That'll be next Thursday at 8 o'clock. So today we're going to do SB 310, which is employment of prisoners. SB 86 will consider again state and municipal liability for attorney fees, and SB 461, legislative disclosures. And is there anything else to come before the committee before we start? Seeing nothing, we will start with SB 310. And just for the committee's information, Senator Green's staff is going to present the bill. Senator Green apologized for not being able to be here, and her staff is also the finance staff in their meeting today, so they're just going to introduce the bill. The department is carrying the bill for the department, and so then I have said that it was fine with us if the staffer went to finance, and so we'll have the department, then we'll be the people who will ask questions, further questions. So would you go ahead and introduce yourself to the committee and present the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Darwin Peterson, staff to the Senate Finance Committee, sponsor of this legislation. And as the chairman said, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the indulgence. The committee is working on a markup on the PPT bill, and it's crucial that I be there, so I really do appreciate that. I'll go ahead and give some opening remarks on the legislation, and we did introduce this at the request of the department. So the department has full faith and credit of the sponsor to go ahead and speak on behalf of the committee. I understand there are some amendments that might come forward as well, and we have discussed those with the department, and we give them all the latitude they need to go ahead and speak for the committee. The legislation that's
And Mr. Peterson, before we go further, I'm not aware of any members that have amendments, but if there are amendments that are going to be proposed by individual members, can the department speak to those amendments as well as those that have been pre-printed and pre-offered?
Yes. Yes, through the chair. We have discussed some issues that have come forth from ASEA and labor, and we've worked out some compromises. So whether or not the ASEA was able to get a sponsor for those amendments, I guess is yet to be determined. But the department does know which amendments the committee is comfortable with. So I guess I would make the assumption that if amendments come forward that the department has never seen before, then they would just let the committee know at that point. But assuming that the amendments that you see, if any, are ones that we've already discussed, then the department does have the authority to go ahead and speak on behalf of the committee. Senate Bill 310 is legislation dealing with the employment of prisoners. The Alaska Correctional Industries Program and the Commission were repealed on July 1st of 2005 when the legislation that created this program was allowed to sunset. This legislation is Senate Bill 310 is needed to provide for the continued employment of prisoners under AS 3330. The bill provides the necessary statutory authorities for the state to take advantage of the critical federal prison industry enhancement program. It's one of the main benefits of the legislation. Also, this new prison employment program and state statute will allow the Department of Corrections to actively participate and partner with private enterprise without creating unfair competition. There are safeguards built into the legislation that deal with prevailing wage requirements and other issues that try to protect the private industry from unfair competition by prison labor. Also, with regard to the state's general fund and state money, this won't be a burden on state coffers, since the entire program will be funded through program receipts generated. Furthermore, this bill allows the department to make a deduction from the offender's wages to apply for the cost of confinement. Teaches the offender responsibility, and it's a tool used in rehabilitation. Inmates that work are that their money is put into an account, and the commissioner is allowed to take deductions from those from that account to pay for child support, victim restitution, criminal fines, civil judgments, even the cost of their own utility fees while they're at the prison. That concludes my brief introductory remarks, Mr. Chairman. This is a vital piece of legislation if the state wants to continue employing prisoners as a tool for rehabilitation.
Great, thank you. Representative Elkins.
Thank you. I think you just answered my question, but I just wanted to be sure that this bill in no way, or shape, or form alters or shuts down the program.
No, it doesn't. No, the previous program that was allowed to sunset, this legislation is basically a redrafting of that without the industry, without the actual commission that oversees it. Instead, the department would oversee the program.
Thank you.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. You talked about the sunset or the repeal by sunset of the previous program. Was that inadvertent, or was there a reason that it was allowed to sunset, and if so, do you know the rationale?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I would go ahead and let the department answer that question when they come up here shortly. I know that the commission was intentionally allowed to sunset. The statutes that were inadvertently allowed to sunset in addition to that are I would let the department speak to that, but this legislation is trying to correct that. Those statutes that were repealed when the commission sunsetted is what this legislation would now put back into effect.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. And just for clarification, this allows the in Seward there's a furniture program. In here in Juneau there's the laundry program. And is this also necessary for the internal cleaning and internal maintenance that is performed by prisoners at the prisons throughout the state?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, those programs that do currently exist at Spring Creek and Seward and here at Lemon Creek and Juneau, those programs would have to discontinue without this legislation, the laundry program and the furniture program. So it's necessary to enact this in order to continue those programs, yes.
Okay, and the second part of my question, that though, is that's also necessary at all the prisons for the prisoners to be able to do the work and the maintenance and the painting and the cleaning. Is that correct, or should we ask that of the department?
I would defer to the department on that question. Sure. Thank you.
That's fine. Does anyone else have any questions for the sponsor, or we can bring the department up next as the first testifier? Thank you, Darwin. Appreciate you coming over and presenting the bill, and we'll...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do apologize. I have to leave, but I appreciate the indulgence.
Thank you. No apologies. No. And so can we get the department to come up? Good morning. Would you introduce yourself and who you're representing for the record?
My name is Charlene Griffin. I'm the Director of Admin Services for the Department of Corrections.
And that was Char?
Char is fine.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay, I believe the last question was whether or not this affected regular prison employment in the correctional facilities as far as doing maintenance and cleaning the facilities and that sort of thing. And yes, it does. There was a provision in the previous statute for exemption from workers' compensation. Without this legislation, the department would have to pay workers' compensation for inmate labor. And the workers' comp portion is not necessary. The department is funded for inmate health care. And if a worker is injured doing anything that they do, the department picks up the cost of that inmate health care. If it exceeds what the department is capable of doing and becomes a risk management issue, then we work with risk management on it. And we do have Mr. Brad Thompson from risk management here today if there are any questions regarding that issue.
Okay. And the other The other question that was brought up, was that Representative Gardner, did you have a question that
regarding the workers' comp?
Oh, regarding the sunset. Could you explain to us how the sunset worked and what happened here?
Yes, I could. The sunset was inadvertent. The legislature, the department, the governor's office of management and budget, everyone in line missed the fact that this legislation was going to sunset.
So the intention was to sunset the commission, and when the commission got sunsetted, so did all the programmatic functions as well?
Yes.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. About the workman's comp or workers' comp, I'm not sure I understood exactly. The workers' comp requirement, did that apply to internal labor for maintenance and routine things within the facility or this employment program?
The only exemption there was for not paying workers' compensation on inmate labor at all, entirely on all inmates, and I'm sorry, through the chair, was in the correctional industry statute. There's not an exemption in the work comp statutes. In addition to that, the 3330201 references the correctional industry statutes 3332 for the exemption of workers' compensation to apply to facility inmate labor.
Okay. Representative Gardner, follow up.
And under this bill, what is the status of workers' comp?
Through the chair, under this bill, all offenders would providing labor would once again be exempted from workers' compensation.
Mr. Chair, and that's
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. For either type of labor, they'd be exempt.
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
Representative Gatto.
Just for clarification, the sunset you refer to, what was that sunset date?
July 1st, 2005, I believe.
So it's already sunsetted. It's not. Already sunsetted. We inadvertently didn't plan on the 06 one. Okay, number two is the work comp issue. If indeed an inmate is so badly hurt, let's say quadriplegic, and is simply let go, who picks up the work comp costs for the rest of that person's life?
I would defer that question to Brad Thompson, if I could invite him to the table.
Sure.
And before you begin, we've been joined by Representative Grunberg, and Representative Lynn's been here since the first, and I don't think, almost the first.
Almost the first.
Good morning.
The first.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Brad Thompson, Director, Division of Risk Management. You've addressed the workers' compensation, the prohibition for the inmate labor. If there is an injury to an inmate within the walls performing service or otherwise.
You're going to have to tilt the microphone in your direction. Go ahead. Steve, repeat that over again because the recorder missed it all.
Okay, I'll start right over. Brad Thompson, Director, Division of Risk Management, Department of Administration. We administer the self-insurance program for workers' comp general liability on behalf of all state agencies. As to inmate injuries, they are precluded and have been precluded from workers' compensation for their involvement in prison industries as well as work within the walls servicing the buildings and being gainfully employed within, or there's a term of art used, productively employed in the statutes currently. should there be an injury that's severe, as you question, Representative Gatto, there may be a tort liability case presented on their behalf. There is not the exclusive remedy protection that an employee is precluded from suing their employer in our involvement with inmates. That's the policy call and the trade-off of not providing the workers' compensation.
Representative Gardner?
If workers' compensation were to be provided, it would be carried by the industry partner, but not the prison industries, if we're talking about the correctional industries program.
If there was workers' compensation provided to the inmate participating in the correctional industries program and they're working for an outside entity, they could, in their purchase of workers' compensation, a statutory policy, also provide remedy to the inmate. But that's a policy call.
And just to clarify, that was for only those inmates that were working in conjunction with another industry, but all of the other exemptions for workers working within the walls of the prison, doing maintenance and painting and cleaning, those things, those wouldn't be covered by any outside. I mean, that's not done in conjunction with any other outside entity, is it?
If they were determined to be employees under the Comp Act, then in this activity, performing service for corrections in the upkeep and maintenance of the facilities, if they were determined to be employees under the Act, then risk management is a self-insured, we provide the self-insurance protection for the state of Alaska as an employer. And so if the State Department of Corrections was defined to be the employer of these individuals, it would be through our offices.
Okay, just to get this clarification then, risk management and corrections in either case is going to be the supplier of medical insurance and basically the workman's comp or tort in beyond what risk management would carry. Is that what I'm understanding?
Maybe I'll try again. The present system is there is no workers' comp. If there is injury, the medical is paid by corrections, as is all medical is being provided to inmates, whether it was accidental or any other cause. In a prison industries program where they're working for an independent party, where they're performing work, developing or building furniture, and they're working for ABC Industries, they today are not eligible for workers' compensation. And so if that changed, if you consider and make both programs, the correctional industries as well as the within the maintenance side, let's call it, if they were defined to be employees, risk management on behalf of corrections would provide the workers' comp for the maintenance activity, and then the independent employer, if they were working for ABC Industries, in their statutory policy would be required to provide workers' comp.
Okay, and I guess my question was on the maintenance side.
Mm-hmm.
Normal employees of the state that have workers' comp, is that's provided through risk management and the department?
The Division of Risk Management provides the workers' compensation remedy owed to any state employee on behalf of Department of Corrections or okay. any other agency.
And if that's not the case, as it hasn't been, then corrections and risk management is still the entity that provides that level of support or protection. Is that correct?
Well, again, today there is no workers' compensation being paid, but there is a tort liability exposure or medical provisions being paid as part of the medical benefit program under corrections.
Okay.
If there is workers' compensation, then the Division of Risk Management would be responsive.
Is this follow-up, Representative Gardner, or another question? Okay, good. Representative Gardner and then Gruenberg.
Okay, there are actually kind of two related questions. First of all, when prisoners are doing the internal maintenance type work, are they paid? And then secondly, is there any reason that we should waive workers' comp for correctional industries, given that it exposes us to risk?
Through the chair, I'll take the first part of the question. Yes, indeed, they are paid, and they are paid anywhere from 30 cents an hour to 60 cents an hour. They work in our kitchens helping provide food. They help our maintenance crew do work. They sweep the floors. They provide janitorial services. They are indeed paid. They are not covered by workers' compensation presently. And to be covered by workers' compensation, there would have to be a rate determined as to how much we needed to provide risk management on that, I believe. And my understanding is that rate would probably be pretty high with the number of inmates that we have working, even though they don't make very much money. Keeping inmates busy, productively busy, mm-hmm. is very important in security. And I'll let Mr. Thompson address the rest of it.
If I could, maybe to try to clarify, that we had a case where an individual that was participating in one of these programs attempted to assert a workers' compensation remedy. Beyond the statutory provision or preclusion today for workers' comp as an inmate.
We're going to have to move the microphone again.
Sorry. There was a case involving an inmate that was involved and injured while performing actually community work as part of his, if you will, his outgoing. When he left the prison industries, he was then in a halfway house and he was performing service, in this case for a nonprofit, as a condition of his release, and he was injured. And he attempted to file for workers' compensation. The Workers' Compensation Board looked at it under the comp law and found that there was no express contract between the employee, as he attempted to become an employee, and the employer, because it didn't meet the tests under the law of employment, because these individuals, they're in the control of the Department of Corrections, or in this case at a halfway house, but it is not the control that an employer has for the employee that would be working on their behalf. So it is legally a different relationship than an employee would under the law be determined with a typical employer. So many states have preclusions for workers' comp, to just clarify the question, such that these individuals working within and outside the walls in these industries, in these industry programs, are not eligible for workers' comp. They are provided medical, and again, if they are injured significantly and there is a tort liability, the state still has an exposure for general liability for these individuals, and we have that today. And we have rare cases involving those, but we do resolve those.
Reverend Grimber.
Had you finished? Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the reasons, Mr. Thompson, that the workers' comp laws came into existence was because employers and potential defendants wanted them. Mm-hmm. Has anybody done a study, either statewide or nationally, in prisoners' kinds of cases? Because you know prisoners love to litigate, and they can litigate pro per. They can file a tort claim pro per, and you have to have a lawyer involved, your own lawyer, risk management, et cetera. Wouldn't it be just cheaper to cover them?
Well, if I may, Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Grunberg, good question. The experience that we've had in performing the and handling the claims that have arisen in our history are rare. Some of them are significant, but again, we have involved Department of Law Special Litigation Section, who we have basically retained on staff in-house counsel, and we do investigate and defend those, and if there is merit or there is exposure, we'll resolve it as we self-administer our liability claims. But those are rare exceptionals as compared to the overall global open the door for every inmate to be able to file under what is typically a pretty easy threshold as far as the presumption of work-relatedness, any ailment, any condition that may have presented itself while they're within walls or perhaps after they've left our care. And the costs associated with workers' comp are very significant.
Thank you, Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I notice in the bill on page 7, line 4, or line 3, we have the dreaded retroactivity date, something that raises a lot of conversation whenever we see that. So I'm really curious. Since you had exceeded the fiscal note in previous legislation, I would assume, how did you manage to pay to keep the operation going, between the time you had essentially no money because it was never appropriated and now?
Through the chair. This is where the sunset of the act was missed by everyone. We received an appropriation from the legislature to from the Correctional Industries Fund, which is an ongoing fund that retains a balance. We make we're appropriated to spend from that fund. We make expenditures and we deposit receipts. And we did not realize on July 1st that it didn't exist. We really didn't figure it out till October-ish. And we continued business as usual. Thus, the retroactive date to cover this year and to change it from the Correctional Industries Fund to Receipt Support Services.
Representative, got a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. I guess, does this mean you have a bank account with money in it that you continue to draw from when you say the fund? And while you're at it, the number two question is going to be, does the retroactivity renewal date effectively take new money and put it backwards into this account to make up for withdrawals that you made from this fund?
Through the chair, could we do that question again? I'm sorry, the first part and then go to the second part.
I guess number one is, do you have a bank account? Is that when you say a fund, or is it just drawing on the general fund? And number two was, does the retroactivity date redeposit money that was taken to pay current bills?
Okay, number one, the fund is a state fund. It was in statute. It is fund number, I believe, 22654, the Correctional Industries Fund, just as many other state funds, the Second Injury Fund, and that type of thing. Number one. Number two, we have continued business. We have continued putting receipts into what was the fund. And so the goal of Correctional Industries is to break even. And for the most part, that's pretty much where we stand this year when we're looking at things. So we had a fund balance of $300,000+ on July 1st.
Oh, five, yes.
So of this fiscal year. And we continued operating as we had in previous years, where that fund, that money was available, and we would make expenditures, and from those expenditures we sold services and products and brought receipts in and deposited them. Okay. So there's no additional funding required to make up for the operations thus far this year.
Thank you.
Representative Lynn, did you have a question?
No.
Representative Elkins, Representative Grunberg, another question at all?
Not now, but they'll be standing by, I assume.
Sure, they will.
Thank you.
I think that's all I had at this time, too. So we'll call you up in a few minutes here if we have other questions. Do we have people online to testify on Senate Bill 310? No one online. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on Senate Bill 310? We don't have anyone else signed up, so I will close the public testimony. And we're here for a committee discussion. Representative Grunberg.
I understood that there's some behind-the-scenes negotiating that are taking place.
We have, I believe, Representative Elkins, do you have an amendment to offer?
I have a conceptual amendment.
Okay. Yeah. We have that on our table there.
Did I get one?
There it is right there, yeah. They're just conceptual movements, and it makes it flow better, I believe. It moves on page 5. It moves line 6 to 16, line 16, and renumbers it 4. It moves 4 to line 18, and renumbers it number 5, and then 5 it line 5 to 20 and renumbers at number 6. It doesn't distract anything from the...
Okay, and did you move that amendment? You moved the amendment, and I will object for discussion.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I would move conceptual amendment number 1 for to SB 310/G.
Okay, thank you, and I will object for discussion. So we're talking about version G on page 5, and we're on line 20. We're taking 6 and would move that, section 6, and moving that to line 16.
Yes.
And make it number 4.
And making it number 4, okay. Let's see. Okay, so what we're doing is this is a priority list that we have here, and so this is the commission shall disperse compensation received in the following order, and we're moving to pay restitution or fine of the prisoner ordered, and we're moving that, which is currently in the last place, and we're moving that above for the payment of fees for the prisoner's utilities services and for the purchase of clothing and commissary items for the prisoner's personal use. Can we have Prison Industries corrections come back up? Would you identify yourself again on the record here?
For the record, Charlene Griffin, Director of Admin Services for the Department of Corrections.
Charlene, could you tell us what this would do if we were taking this order of payments, and if we put restitution above clothing and commission commissary items and above prisoner utility services, what would that do to the program?
The department would support that. The previous statute, the current order of priorities is exactly as it was in the previous statute, and the department would support restitution being paid prior to the offender utilities and the amount of money they're allowed to spend on commissary. All it would do is simply change the order that we applied deductions once they were paid their offender wages. When it posted to their account, we would first look to see if they had child support and on down the line. So we would check for any restitution owed prior to paying their utilities and allowing them to spend money on commissary items.
Okay, and I guess my question is, let's say there was a $25,000 restitution or $50,000 restitution that was required. How would that be apportioned? Does that mean the prisoner sees nothing for buying any commissary items or clothing until all of the that entire $25,000 would be paid, or is it proportional?
It is proportional. Child support orders are first, and they generally have a percentage of the wages that is to be paid. That's usually stated in the order. And on down the line. So a percentage of that restitution would be paid monthly, which would leave the offender with less money to spend on commissary items, but would not make the offender not want to work at all to repay that restitution because they saw zero funds out of it that they could spend on commissary.
Okay, and I guess I'm just trying, and do you currently, is there some percentage with it in line 6 here? In section 6, is there currently a percentage of their wages that do go to restitution anyway?
I will have to check on exactly how that reads. I believe part of it depends on how the court order reads. as far as their restitution goes. But I believe that there is a percentage applied as it goes down the line, and I will follow up on that for you.
Okay, I'm just concerned that if there is nothing, I mean, I haven't seen anything in the statute that says that you will only take out a percentage of it for this. I mean, court orders for dependents and those kind of things are generally listed on percentages, and I'm not sure if restitutions are done the same way. And I want to make sure that by making this change that we don't get into the legal hole of making it so that the prisoner has zero incentive for participating in the program, and then you end up with very incorrigible people with no leverage over them. So,
yes. And I will follow up and get you that answer.
Okay, that's fine. Does anyone else have any questions about this reprioritization? Seeing none, I'll remove my objection, but I will want to make sure that you get back to us on this issue. So if it needs to be, I mean, if the situation outlines that it would go to zero, then I think that we would destroy the program, and that's no one's intent here. So we would follow that up if that becomes the case. But I'll remove my objection from the amendment. And so seeing no objection, amendment number one, reprioritizing page 5, moving section 6 from line 20 to line 16, and renumbering accordingly, has passed State Affairs. Are there any other amendments? Representative Groomer.
I understand that the parties are working out some accommodations, so I would hope we'd give them time to come back with their amendment.
Well, I'm hoping that they have been working with and that we have an amendment here. Is anyone have? Representative Gardner.
Oh, do you have one?
Well, I have a potential amendment, but I'd like to sort of explore it a little bit, if I may, with the Department of Division of Corrections.
Representative Gardner, you may.
Thank you. I'm troubled by the workers' comp issue, and looking at the bill and trying to see exactly where that's discussed, I see page 6, line 28, well, actually line 30, it says, Workers' Compensation Act do not apply to inmates employed in a prison program operated by the Department of Corrections. When prisoners are working for an external company, correctional industries, does that fall under prison program operated by the Department of Corrections, or does that phrase refer to the internal works?
Correctional industries in itself is a program operated by the Department of Corrections. Not all correctional industry programs involve a free venture or a vendor outside the department. For instance, we have a sewing factory in Highland Mountain Correctional Center that currently makes all of our inmate clothing. They make the shirts and the pants and the socks, and they make jackets and that sort of thing. So not all correctional industry programs involve the public sector.
Okay.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does it make sense to draw a line between the employment which is paid, funded through the Department of Corrections, and employment which is paid by an outside organization?
It would work in some cases if it is a prison industry enhancement program, a PI program, that the federal regulations for those PI programs allow either workers' compensation or its equivalent. In a more of a free venture program, similar to what we currently have with the Los Laundry and Dry Cleaners, the company pays to the department minimum wage for all hours worked by inmates, but the inmates are only allowed to have 50% of minimum wage posted to their account for their pay. So that would get a little confusing on what you were paying workers' compensation on. I suppose another concern I might have about defining them as employees for the purposes of workers' compensation is that currently the state files 1099s for inmate labor, as opposed to wage statements that have all of the withholdings from them. So I haven't really looked into that, whether if the employer were paying workers' compensation, if we would have some offenders receiving W-2s and from the private employer, and those working in the institution and industries receiving 1099s, or what the effect of all of that would be.
Thank you.
Ms. Jay, and so is that a 1099 miscellaneous income statement is what you're doing, or is there a separate 1099 item line for that?
It is a 1099 MISC.
1099 miscellaneous. Okay, Representative Lynn, did I see you had a question?
Well, after Representative Gardner's done, I just had another question about potential amendments.
Sure, and Representative Gardner, did you have any more follow-ups on?
I think I'd maybe like to explore this further, because I do have concerns about the whole workers' comp issue, and if they're paid externally on an hourly rate that's minimum wage or more, you know, they really are employees of some other agency, and I don't understand. I mean, I don't agree with saving the employer workers' comp money and opening the state to liability. But I don't think we have to do that here. If there's another opportunity to maybe have an amendment ready for next time.
Representative Lynn?
I could address that. I believe that there has been discussion among the attorneys as to having those contracts with private vendors read in such a manner that they are also liable, that there must be some sort of insurance coverage, not necessarily workers' compensation, but the company must carry insurance that would help in the case of an injury.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Risk management is going to come back up, I think, and address.
For the record, Brad Thompson, Risk Management. As Char mentioned, in our contract agreements with these independent vendors, we would require them to hold the state harmless for claims arising from these activities and operations, and we would make them carry a liability policy such that they would have the means to effect the commitment to hold us harmless. And so those injuries typically would occur while they're not on our premises, or if in fact they're on our premises, they have the directional management and control of the inmate at that time. So they have the responsibility to resolve the claim.
Reverend Gardner.
Thank you. And has there ever been occasion to actually rely on those policies?
If I can, through the chair, there has been claim history where there has been injury to inmates off-premise involving a contractual tender of defense, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And
well, I just had a
Representative Lynn.
That question, not to the folks here, I don't believe. But you'd mentioned earlier, Mr. Chair, that something is being worked out, and I want to get, you know, the nature of what's being worked out, because if this has anything to do with provisions that would protect law-abiding workers from competition from criminals, criminal workers. Is that the nature of what's being worked out?
And the last correction here.
Through the chair, that is the nature of what's being worked out. There are provisions in the Prison Industry Enhancement Program that require, before you begin a PI program, that you meet with organized labor, that you involve the Department of Labor to determine what prevailing wage is, and that it not create competition for organized bargaining units or displace workers. Now, that is in the PI program, and my understanding is what we are working towards is having something very similar, if not the same, apply to any industry that is would be free venture with a private organization.
Fine, and we'll be having an amendment coming of some type to look at? Or?
I believe so, and that's the question.
I believe so. A lot of work was done yesterday. Deputy Commissioner Parker was working on this information, and she's unavailable today. But I believe that is the content of the amendment that needs to be offered.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lynn. So we could look for that in the next few days before next Tuesday. I mean, it's not our intent to hold this bill up, but we do want to make sure that we incorporate, you know, the amendments that are needed.
Yes, I know there were folks working on the text of the amendment yesterday.
Okay, fine. Are there any other amendments that people are working with? And Representative Gardner, in the intervening days, would you work with the Department of Corrections to see if everybody has their full understanding, and if there's going to be an amendment offered, we could get that in writing, and or what the understanding is. I just want to make sure that at our next meeting that we get all the amendments that we can coming forward at the time, instead of trying to develop them during committee.
Thank you,
Representative Gardner. Is there any other discussion on this bill? Is there anything else the department wishes to add this time?
This piece of legislation is critical to pass to keep our inmates productively employed. Employment of inmates, having inmates working and busy, is vital to security of an institution. Idle hands create problems, and we want to keep our offenders employed. It helps them to learn life skills, such as getting up, going to work every morning, that they have an obligation. It helps them to pay their child support, their restitution, in some cases to save money for when they are released from prison. It's a very positive program that's also a security tool for the department, and it's critical to safe operations of our facilities.
And you will, at the next meeting, have that response about the reprioritization of the deductions and how that would affect the amounts that would be available to a prisoner, as well as the incentive that will create or eliminate.
Yes, I will.
Okay, thank you. Representative Lynch.
I just had to make the comment that about they get into trouble with idle hands. Well, they got into prison by having busy hands. That's how they got there.
Not the right busy.
Got to remove the hands.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. And we will take this up. It will not be the first order of business on Tuesday. Oh, yeah.
It will run
on. We'll be on Tuesday, because Thursday is when we will have the presentation by the Division of Elections. And that will be first on the agenda on Thursday. So,
are you demonstrating against us now? Some kind of demonstration?
So, thank you. We'll put that bill aside and take it up. Yes, Representative Elkins.
You're talking about Tuesday, and Representative Rangers, we don't get that till 2, a lot of us, do we?
Session is at 2. I think we have a regular day.
I'm coming in not too far before 2 o'clock.
Yes.
I wonder if it'd be possible to meet later in the day on Tuesday after session.
Oh boy.
We'll consider that a little later here. But if it's not on Tuesday, it won't be. The first item of business on Thursday is the Division of Elections,
right,
and we
I'm
want to make sure
that
we get this. So.
I'm not bringing that up to slow the legislation, because I want to see it pass. But
No. I appreciate the comment, and we'll figure that out before the end of our meeting. Is there any further comments on 310? Okay, we'll put that aside, and we'll go to SB 86. Thank you for coming.
Yeah.
Okay, and we have SB 86, and would you go ahead and reintroduce yourself for the record?
I will. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Randy Ruaro. I'm the legislative liaison for the Department of Law, actually standing in for Mr. Tillery today. I'm not as studied on the bill as he is, but I'll do the best I can to answer your questions. Mr. Tillery did advise me that there were at least two questions that were left hanging from the last meeting. One, I'll start with the first one, which was that the committee members had expressed a concern that the bill would mandate a payment by the state in an appeal of 20% to 30% of the party's prevailing party's actual reasonable fees. And in fact, that's a cap, not a mandated amount. And if you look at page 2, line 11, I think the language there, award exceeding, is not liable to pay an attorney fee award exceeding the following. So it's a cap, not a mandated payment amount. So I think that clarifies that question.
I got a page problem here.
I get a page problem here, too.
Did they say page 2, line 11?
Right.
In this in is version Y?
A.
No,
a.
I
G point A.
Yeah, I have G point A.
Well, that would make a difference.
Which is
that's the Senate. It's the CSSB 86 CRA effective date fail
point. One.
Come on, I'll keep up.
You have G, not G point A. Just a second, we'll get a. Do we have copies of the of G point A? Some people have G and some have G point A. We'll take a brief at ease.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the version G point A on page 2, lines 10 and 11, I think the language is not liable to pay an attorney fee award exceeding the following. It makes it clear that the award amount is a cap. It's not a mandatory amount that must be paid.
That was my question, so, Mr. Chair.
Okay, fine. That Representative Grunberg?
May I just ask general questions?
Let's go over this question. There were two questions I believe we left him AG with last time, and so we want to get through those questions first, and then we'll come to general.
Well, questions. I have a question on this. It's kind of a comment. If your intent is to limit the courts in what they can procedurally award, I don't think this act is effective to do that because it doesn't have a title that says it amends the appellate rules or it doesn't amend the civil rules, and it doesn't have the required two-thirds vote, obviously. So are you aware of that deficiency in the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that's actually, I think, the second issue that the chair and the committee had asked us to research, and I've done some of that research. I'll run through what I found. Your point is that bill affects a court rule change, therefore mandating the title requirement and the two-thirds vote.
It affects at least two, Rule 82 and the appellate rule as well.
Right, and I guess on that point, through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I would disagree that it affects a court rule. The public interest litigant doctrine isn't spelled out, I believe, in either 82 or 508. Those rules speak generally to awards of attorney's fees, but the public interest litigant doctrine, I believe, is case law, starting with the McCabe case and then proceeding through a number of other cases. And I believe that the two-thirds vote requirement applies to rules of procedure that are expressly promulgated by the court. and that the public interest litigant doctrine is not contained in either of those rules.
Do you, through the chair, and this goes to judiciary next, I believe. We can explore this further here.
That's
but,
correct.
But I think for the edification of this committee, that seems to me a fairly novel legal theory. Do you have any precedent to support your position?
Well, I believe the cases themselves, if you look at McCabe and the other cases on the public interest litigant doctrine, they speak about the doctrine and the right to receive attorney's fees. But if you look at the language of Rule 82, I don't believe the term public interest litigant or the amounts that are to be awarded public interest litigants or the a rule that fees will not be apportioned among issues if you're a public interest litigant, none of that appears in the language of the rules. It's all case law as far as I could tell.
Granted, if I may just follow up.
Grimmer.
What the argument that he's making is, as I understand it, Mr. Rohrer, correct me if I'm wrong, is that because the rule itself is established in the case, mm-hmm. therefore the constitutional provision doesn't apply. I'm not aware of any case holding to that effect, are you?
Well, through the chair, Representative Grunberg, there is a case that talks about the test that courts to apply, and that's Nolan v. Sierra Motive, 627 P. 2nd, 1035. And in that case, the court talks about that there has to be an initial finding that the statute that the legislature passed actually conflicts with a rule promulgated by the court. And that language, to me, says that it has to be an express rule that the court has adopted. If that is not the test, then, you know, how do you tell, how would you ever tell when a decision by the court would trigger the two-thirds requirement? I think the distinction is a bright-line test, and that's whether or not the court has expressly adopted it as a rule. If it were not, the legislature would be left to guess every time the court issued a decision whether or not, is this a two-thirds requirement, is it not? So I guess I read Nolan to require a bright-line test of whether it actually appears in a rule.
Mr. Chair, just another question.
Reverend Grunberg.
About 3 or 4 years ago, when we passed a similar bill limiting attorneys' fees, that case did not receive the two-thirds, and that legislation did not receive the requisite two-thirds votes. And at least the Superior Court struck it down on that basis, did it not?
Are you speaking of HB 145?
I don't remember the number. Your memory's better than mine, sir.
Yeah. I think that's the bill you're discussing, and the Superior Court Judge Collins did hold that there was a two-thirds vote requirement. I believe, you know, and the state's position on appeal is that she was incorrect.
That may be the state's position,
Reverend Grunberg.
But that case, as it stands, is directly opposite to this bill and your position here. So why don't you be certain and put that in?
Well, through the chair, Representative Grunberg, there's additional reasons why this bill does not require a two-thirds vote beyond that distinction that the judge made in that case. And the next point that I would make is that Article 2, Section 21 of the Constitution specifically grants the legislature the authority to provide the rules for sovereign immunity of the state and municipalities. That was not present in HB 145, so there's a distinction to make between HB 145 and the basis or the authority for SB 86, which is SB 86 is a function or a result of the legislature using its very specific constitutional grant of authority to exercise a core function, which is to protect the state in the means it deems fit. And I would argue that specific grant of authority, even if public interest litigant doctrine was embodied in a court rule, must give way to that to the legislature's authority under Article 2, Section 21. And the language there says it specifically grants the legislature the authority to determine the procedures for suits against the state. So I guess my position would be that even if public interest litigant doctrine is part of a court rule, it must give way to the specific constitutional grant of authority to the legislature in Article 2, Section 21.
Representative Grimmer,
One more question.
Yeah.
Any precedent for that opinion?
There is a case. It's Alaska v. the O/S Lynn Kendall. It's not exactly on point, but it does say the Constitution of the State of Alaska grants to the legislature the sole and exclusive power to enact laws establishing the terms and conditions upon which the state may be sued. And I would just note that the position I'm arguing is also consistent with the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Alyeska Pipeline v. Wilderness Society and other federal decisions where the courts have noted that it would be inappropriate for the judiciary to create a general rule independent of statute to allow attorney fee awards in the courts, and that those matters are subject to Congress's determinations. So I guess I would argue my position is also consistent with U.S. Supreme Court law.
If it would be possible through the chair for you to provide copies of those cases as soon as you can, either while the bill's here or if the bill goes to judiciary before it gets there, because that's at the core of this whole issue. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Through the chair, I will do that.
That's fine. And, you know, and myself, I don't think that that's at the core of the issue. I think the core of the issue is whether we're proceeding on the basis of making sure that the public has a reasonable access to redress bad laws that are possibly unconstitutional that we create, or ordinances that violate state law. And so I think the core issue here is whether a financial burden of making individual citizens who challenge their government for non-economic reasons, for not personal gain, but because the law is wrong constitutionally, or an ordinance violates a statute or constitution, whether we are going to raise a bar for those people so that they will be less able to sue, because if they win, they're still going to have huge out-of-pocket expenses if we only allow 20% reimbursement of their actual expenses if they fully win on the main case. And I guess that, to me, is the large public policy issue that we're talking about here, much, much greater than if we're talking about a court rule change or something like that. I mean, state affairs, we're looking at it from the other perspective, not from quite the judicial perspective. So would you like to address that
Sure.
a little bit before we go to public testimony?
Sure. I certainly didn't mean to dispute what you're saying also.
Mr. Chairman, I understand your concern, and I think the answer is that all of the things you mentioned can still be in place. It's simply that the legislature will be the entity that's exercising the authority to determine that, as opposed to the court system.
And let me go back. If this goes in place, how is the legislature exercising that authority?
Well, the legislature could pass a statute. If SB 86 were passed and a particular group or entity wanted to receive the right to recover enhanced fees, they would lobby the legislature, and the legislature could pass a statute similar to what they've done, I guess, in the consumer protection arena or eminent domain or other exceptions that the legislature has on the books now, and receive that exception. But in the first instance, I guess the entity making that policy decision would be the legislature, as opposed to the court system.
So just to follow up, are you talking about on specific cases? If someone had specific cases where they had won one in the courts, and we could come back and pass a specific law to say that those people that didn't have an economic gain but defended the right of the public to make sure that there was good legislation and constitutional legislation, we could come back and pass an appropriation bill to, or an amendment to an appropriation to actually pay their full attorney fees, or are you talking about a general situation?
Through the chair, I'm talking about a situation where rather than going back and making an appropriation after the case is over, a group or an interested party would have a bill introduced or legislator would introduce a bill that said this class or this group of litigants is entitled to receive enhanced attorney's fees, and here's why. The legislature would act on it, and then in subsequent cases that fell within that category, those entities would be entitled to receive the fee, enhanced fees.
Thank you. I think that might be good for something like the when a political party at the last reapportionment, challenged reapportionment, and it's in fact it's the second largest year in suit cases under public interest litigants. I think that there might be the clout there, but what we're talking about here is looking at the small guy on the municipal level or the individuals that are challenging state laws and the ability of individuals that, you know, we are trying to protect under, you know, public policy. I don't think that the chance of getting those any kind of legislation like that through for them is very large. So anyway, we'll just this has been discussion with the district, but with the department. So we'll go to the public testimony next, and I'm sure you'll be here further. Thank you.
Thank you.
In Fairbanks, we have Robert Sparks. Are you online?
Yes, I am.
Yes, would you identify not only who you are, but who you represent, and go ahead with your testimony, Mr. Sparks.
I'm here as an individual today. I'm an attorney here in Fairbanks. I grew up in Fairbanks. I attended Lathrop High School. I have a degree in accounting and finance from Oklahoma State University. I have a degree from University of Oklahoma in law. I've had my own law office here in Fairbanks since about 1990.
Great, thank you. Would you go ahead? I presume you have the bill there in Fairbanks. Go ahead and give your testimony, please.
Well, I have a specific example. I had a client a few years ago that had a driver's licensing issue with the city of Fairbanks, where the city of Fairbanks was requiring that to obtain a taxi cab license that this person have comply with requirements that were way beyond the requirements for obtaining a driver's license under state law. That person, didn't have a lot of money, and eventually we got the city to agree to issue him his taxi cab license. But the problem is that if this statute was passed and he had to file a lawsuit, there's no way he'd be able to afford to file that lawsuit to get the city to comply with state law, because he didn't have the money to do that. And if I was only going to look at getting 20 or 30% of my actual attorney's fees and costs back for doing that lawsuit, there's no way that person would have been able to get his driver's license so that his taxi permit so that he could have continued earning a living. I think that, basically this law is very short-sighted and has vast unforeseen ramifications that are substantially going to change the public justice outcomes in Alaska. It limits the abilities of citizens to make the state comply with its own laws by making the citizen pay 70 or 80% of the actual attorney's fees for a situation where the state's not complying or a municipality's not complying with its own laws. I think that's just outrageous. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. If I could ask a little about this case, I don't want to get into too much detail, but you were representing him as a regular attorney. Does the same kind of issue come up if somebody would be representing pro bono, or is there
problem is that for pro bono, there's a whole lot of instances where people do pro bono work for people that don't have any money, as far as like family law cases. I'm on the list for Alaska Legal Services to help people with eviction cases that don't have any money. You just can't say that, well, we'll have pro bono attorneys do this kind of work, because there's a lot of pro bono work that's going undone right now, because there's so many people that have legal problems that need help that don't have the ability to pay the attorney's fees for them. In this circumstance, you know, you're talking about trying to get the state or a municipality to comply with either a state or the municipality's own charter or law, and it doesn't seem to me that when you win in a case like that it's necessarily punishment for the municipality or the state to have to pay the attorney's fees that they caused the person to run up to make the municipality or the state comply with their own law.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sparks. Does anyone have a question for Mr. Sparks?
Yeah, I do.
Representative Gruenberg?
You could ask. I'm not going to ask. Okay. Well, I'll ask. This is on behalf of me anyway. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sparks, and I'm going to ask this to each of the witnesses. And I think a legitimate issue has been raised by some of us. How do we ensure that the legal system isn't being abused by private litigants who are just, you know, litigating non-meritorious claims against the government?
Well, the legislature is in charge of appointing the Superior Court judges, and you have to have some faith that the system's going to work the way it's supposed to work. This system has been in place for hundreds of years. It was developed over time. It's, you know, the most just system, I think, if you look in every country in the world, it, as far as overall outcomes over a large number of cases, our justice system is very efficient, and it provides, I think, the best result for the people that are injured or that have complaints.
Through the chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
In the award of attorney's fees under the case law, do the courts look at whether the lawsuits are frivolous, whether they're over-litigated, this sort of thing? Do the court rules, Rule 82, and the appellate rules currently provide that kind of protection as well?
Yeah, the court rules provide the judge with great discretion to be able to determine what the attorney's fees are. If the judge thinks that the plaintiff's attorney spent too much time on an issue or spent too much time on the whole case, they can cut the attorney's fees back to what they believe is a reasonable amount and give you a percentage of what they believe is the reasonable amount. In my experience, I haven't seen any instances where in a case involving a state or a municipality that I thought that a judge had gone overboard and awarded anybody too much attorney's fees on a case against the state. I've seen some cases where the state or a municipality was sued and the judge gave, I thought, the state or municipality way too much attorney's fees for prevailing in the case. But I haven't seen any situations where the state or municipality has been, you know, screwed over by the judges that are appointed by the legislature. You know, I mean, you got some really competent judges with a lot of integrity. They know what the law is. They follow the law. If you look at the court rules, Rule 82 has many exceptions to award of percentages of attorney's fees. But the big advantage of Rule 82 is that it reduces the incentive for people. If you take away the having to pay attorney's fees, it reduces the overall incentive for the state and municipalities to exercise reasonable care and take reasonable actions. To the extent that they have to pay the attorney's fees that they cause people to run up by doing unconstitutional stuff or causing people to be injured or whatever, or killed, basically you're putting the cost onto the people that are causing the problem. And that's the way to create a disincentive for people to cause accidents or take unreasonable actions, is you make them pay the consequences of that. And that, whether it's a state agency, whether it's a municipality, if that entity has to pay the attorney's fees, that's part of the sting of doing something bad. I mean, as a private person, that's part of what you'd have to pay if you get in a car accident, if you commit a crime, you're going to have to pay, you're going to have to pay attorney's fees for the public defender. You have to pay court costs. You have to pay fines. You have to go to jail. I mean, it's the same thing. It should be the same thing for the state.
I just have one more follow-up.
Mr. Sparks, I wanted to check with you on this point. You know, we have some of the paperwork here This states that litigants are considered the prevailing party if they succeed on the main issue. There has been something that's been questioned for a while about public interest litigants, that they didn't need to, and this is citing Hillman and versus Nationwide Mutual Fire Insurance, Alaska 1993. As far as you're aware, is there a different standard so that a public interest litigant could just win on a very minor technicality and then gets full attorney fees? Or do they have to do the same thing and weren't prevail on the main issue?
Well, my understanding is that the public interest litigant, you're only going to get compensated for the issues that you win. So if there's a bunch of issues in the case and you only win one minor issue, the judge isn't going to give you all your attorney's fees. The judge is going to give you a very small part of your attorney's fees for the issue that you won. This isn't a situation where the judge just writes a blank check to a public interest litigant. Basically, the public interest litigant, you know, basically has to justify their fee petition. They have to file a motion for attorney's fees. They have to file a detailed statement about everything they did, how much time it took, what all the costs were, and then the judge decides whether that's reasonable or not. And, I mean, you've got a judge that's on the state's payroll that's been, you know, appointed by the governor and everybody that has a lot of education and credibility and training, and those people are, you know, basically their job is to look at those fee applications and make sure that they're reasonable, and I think that we can rely on those people to do their job.
Okay, thank you, and Milt, and Representative Grunberg had one follow-up.
Yeah, Mr. Sparks, just one question. If the trial court awards attorney's fees against the government and the government feels that they're too high, can the government appeal that issue?
In my experience, the government usually appeals those issues when they if they believe that the judge has been unreasonable, and the Supreme Court is very amenable to reviewing those cases and is very critical in its review of the awards of attorney's fees if it believes that they're excessive or unreasonable in any manner.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sparks. We also have in Fairbanks Barry Donnellan. Are you online?
Yes, sir.
Would you identify yourself and who you represent and go ahead with your testimony?
Yes, I'm Barry Donnellan. I'm an attorney here in Fairbanks. I've been in Fairbanks for 30 years, thereabouts. I don't represent any public interest litigants, but I have represented over the years private parties dealing with the state. And in my opinion, the predicate for this bill is to save money in a time of fiscal scarcity. In my opinion, the big problem with litigation with the state lies with the state's law firm and not with the private litigant. I have experience in a case in which the state's law firm spent tens and tens of thousands of dollars defending a point, and at the end of the case, the state's law firm contradicted the very point that they spent tens of thousands of dollars defending. But my client doesn't have any money, so can't carry the case any further. If we want to save money, what we need to do is instill a little bit of fiscal responsibility with the state's law firm and not with the private law firm. The state's law firm has no concept whatsoever of fiscal responsibility. My experience is that the state's law firm defends the state even when the state is obviously wrong. And I can prove that to any reasonable party. As I said, in the one particular case I'm concerned about, the state's law firm contradicts at the end of the case the very point that they started out to defend. I would recommend that the state, that the attorney fees to a prevailing party be increased to 100%, not cut back to 20%. And as somebody else has said earlier, I think it's very serious when the state considers raising the bar against a private citizen raising a grievance with the state.
Thank you, Mr. Donnellan. Does anyone have any questions? Representative Grunberg.
Barry, this is Max Grunberg. Just wanted to say hello. Glad to have you on the phone.
Thank you, Max.
Okay, now we'll go to Anchorage. We have Michael McLeod Ball. Are you online?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Would you go ahead and identify yourself, who you represent, and continue with your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michael McLeod Ball. I'm the executive director of the ACLU of Alaska. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to address this issue. I'll try to answer Representative Grunberg's question first. The short answer to the question of what do you do about frivolous lawsuits is, well, you don't need to do anything about them because under the existing rules, if you're not successful in your case, you don't get an award of attorney's fees. And certainly frivolous lawsuits are not going to be successful. So that's really not at issue in this particular discussion. ACLU of Alaska opposes SB 86 on the grounds that it will have a chilling effect on the ability of parties acting in the public interest to challenge the inappropriate exercise of governmental authority. The bill will tend to widen the legal advantage currently held by governmental litigants over private individuals. The ACLU of Alaska, I will say parenthetically, will be affected, but not as much as other individuals and nonprofit organizations that will benefit from the existing rule. The reason for that is that most of our cases are brought on constitutional grounds, and most constitutional claims have separate award of fee provisions in the statute. But the bottom line here is that if this legislation is enacted, citizen oversight of government will be thwarted. And I think that is a bad thing for Alaska as a whole. The typical plaintiff in a public interest lawsuit is an individual or a nonprofit advocacy organization or a charitable organization. Atypical defendant in such a suit is a governmental entity, often the federal or state government, due to the nature of the issues commonly litigated. However, your reports clearly show that the public interest cases are brought just as regularly against quasi-public or even private entities. There can be no dispute that the typical suit pits a party with limited financial resources who needs to hire outside counsel against a governmental or other private entity with access to substantially greater financial and legal resources. As often as not, the dispute is over principle and very rarely over any substantial amount of money. Compare this to any other type of litigation. First, private suits almost always involve a fight over money or property interests. Typically, general civil litigation pits business against business or individual against individual. Certainly, there are disparities in each party's ability to cope with the cost of litigation, but that's a matter of happenstance. The public interest litigant is financially disadvantaged and typically does not have the prospective benefit of a money damages award. As a result, attorneys are not readily available to take on such cases without sizable retainers. It's simply not profitable for those attorneys to do so. Therefore, the public interest litigant is legally disadvantaged as well because the governmental adversary will always have counsel on board from the start. In his letter of transmittal, the governor complains that the public interest litigant is being subsidized by the current system of attorney fee reimbursement. But bear in mind that the public interest litigant only receives reimbursement if A, he or she is acting in the public interest, and B, he or she is successful in showing that the government acted wrongly, unlawfully. On the other hand, the government gets its subsidy from the taxpayers, whether it wins or not. It's not as if the individual within the government who caused the government to violate that victim's rights is made to reimburse the taxpayers for the internal costs of running the government in a manner violative of the public interest. The key is to set up a system that does not reward improper behavior, and there will be no incentive for the government to stop unlawful action if there is no one willing to speak out against such action through public interest legal action. Who will this bill affect? It will affect those in our society least able to afford it, the poor, the uneducated, the minorities, the disabled, the elderly, all of whom have benefited from public interest litigation at one time or another, many of whom would not have been able to bring such actions in their own right. It won't make a difference to the wealthy individual who funds the public interest lawsuit. For such individuals, attorney fee reimbursement is not a significant consideration. Rather, this law will discourage normal, everyday people and small nonprofit organizations from trying to make a difference when they see the government failing to do its job. If this bill becomes law, the state government will be able to rest easier that it can act against the public interest because it will be less likely to be held to account for its wrongful actions. I have some additional comments here that I'd like to make. First of all, I won't go into the two-thirds vote for the court rule change because I believe you've examined that issue. However, I would suggest that it might be appropriate to wait for the Supreme Court to rule on the pending case before you take further legislative action that would further muddy the waters. Also, I would take note that in this legislation, there appears to be an exception for eminent domain cases. Fees can be awarded in such cases. So if it's okay to award fees for eminent domain cases, why not other unlawful acts by the government? What is it about eminent domain cases that makes them supportive of an award of attorney's fees if the government acts wrongly, but not other violations? What about government negligence? What about violations of open meeting laws or violation of equal protection rights or due process rights or free speech rights or restrictions on free exercise of religion? What about violation of election laws? Who's to say that a property taking is somehow worthy of fee reimbursement and is somehow superior to all these other very legitimate claims? Finally, I would just say, there was one other comment. There was a gentleman here before who I think is also on your testimony list, Ken Jacobus, who represents a number of conservative organizations. He had to leave for a court appearance, but asked us to report that that he also opposes this because this will affect not just organizations on the left, but also organizations on the right and in the middle. And he has represented such conservative organizations on a fairly regular basis in public interest litigation actions. In short, I would say this bill is presented as if the government is unfairly required to pay for a vengeful individual's lawsuit against the state. And I think nothing could be further from the truth. This bill will simply make it harder for someone who's acting in the public interest to force the government to comply with its legal obligations. And the ACLU of Alaska would strongly urge you to reject this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. If you are in contact with Mr. Jacobus, could you ask him to send his testimony in writing for us?
I will certainly do that. Actually, we had a conversation about that before he left.
Okay. Appreciate that. And he can send that to my office as the committee chair, and I'll make sure the committee has it. We have a question from Representative Gatto and then Representative Gardner.
Yeah, this is Representative Gatto first. There was an article in the February 18th paper, and I'm not sure which paper it was, but Governor aims at legal fees. And there was just one comment. It said, noting that Alaska is the only state that awards repayment of all legal fees to winning litigants. Is that an accurate statement? And if so, could you comment on how it came about that we stand alone among 50 states?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I'm not quite sure if I can give you a complete answer to that question because there are so many exceptions to the rule. As you know, there are many, many statutes that call for award of attorney's fees, and those statutes will vary from one state to another. For example,
If you can hear us, we lost you. Would you check and see if your phone's on mute? Are we still online?
My God, I thought I lost my hearing.
It reminds me, Mr. Chair, that this reminds me of a movie called The Five Pennies, starring Danny Kaye, which Danny Kaye was a trumpet player.
We will go on. We don't have a lot of time here. We're going to go on instead of talking about Danny Kaye and...
I'm going to get the rest of it later.
We'll,
we need an Eddie's.
Oh, we need an Eddie's? Okay, we'll go at Eddie's. In order.
They jumped off.
Are you back with us?
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. You just started to answer your question and the phone lines went dead, so... we missed. Hope you weren't talking for all that time.
I would have still been talking.
Well, we do have a short meeting here. We got another bill too.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I will. I'll try and summarize just what I said. The answer is a little bit complicated because each state has slightly different rules. Some states have a greater number of statutes that award attorney's fees. Some states in almost all states, the courts have discretion to award attorney's fees, but it's are you still there?
Yes, we are.
Oh, okay. We just had a pop on this end. And so some courts will interpret their discretion somewhat more broadly than others. But the short answer is that Alaska, I believe, is the only state that follows the rule that says, as a matter of course, the losing party pays a portion of the winning party's fees. Reason for that is to try to discourage frivolous lawsuits, frankly. If you file a frivolous lawsuit, you know you're going to lose, and you know you're going to have a penalty in the form of having to pay a portion of the other side's attorney's fees. And beyond that, there can be sanctions awarded as well.
Okay, thank you. See no other questions. We'll go on.
I have one question.
Wait a minute, I guess. We have Gardner.
Thank you. I would just like to ask Mr. McLeod Ball for a copy of his testimony if he has it in written form.
Yeah, and I was going to ask everyone to send in their testimony in writing if they have it. Representative Gruenberg.
I had asked earlier Mr. Sparks about what is in place to discourage frivolous suits, and I'm not going to ask you that because his answer was so complete. But as you know, under Rule 82, there's subsection B3, as I recall, that puts some sidebars on, among other things, frivolous suits. You're familiar with that rule, right, Mr. McLeod Ball?
Yes, I will say, Representative Gruenberg, that I'm not licensed to practice in Alaska, but I have become familiar with it through my position here and as executive director.
I'm not sure whether that subsection applies in the public interest arena, but would you have any problems with making sure that that does apply so that the rule would explicitly say that, you know, the court can take into consideration if the lawsuit is frivolous?
Through the chair, absolutely not. We would have no problem with that. Our practice is not to file a lawsuit unless we are very confident we're going to win for a lot of different reasons. But certainly we're not in the practice of filing a lawsuit that is frivolous by any stretch of the imagination.
Okay, thank you. We'll now go to Eva Southwer. Are you here? I'm sorry. I didn't see it was signed up. Carrie Robinson is.
I'm here.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Lou, would you? You don't have to get close to the mic.
Oh, okay.
Just have it pointed toward you. And then would you identify yourself, who you represent for the record, and go ahead with your testimony.
Right. Thank you. I want to first thank the committee for taking public testimony. My name is Carrie Robinson, and I'm an attorney with the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And I have worked with the network for the past 10 years in that capacity. And I echo all the comments from the director of the ACLU and prior testimony. We strongly oppose Senate Bill 86 for many of the important public policy reasons the chair has stated. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about, we were a successful public interest litigant back in 1997, and we were forced to sue the Alaska court system to, in a sense, to properly implement the 1996 Domestic Violence Act. And so here we were challenging to actually have the legislative mandate and statute properly enforced. And so I want to echo that a small nonprofit does not take on litigation like that without serious consideration. We would never file a frivolous lawsuit. It's a huge investment of staff time, and we really consider, you know, what the public impact of litigation is. I also want to echo that this bill would affect people in our society who are least likely to be able to protect their rights. We're talking about victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. As the ACLU testified, we're talking about the poor, minority groups, the disabled, and the elderly. If this bill passed, it would severely limit our ability as a nonprofit to take action for victims' rights in similar types of litigation that we did back in 1997. And I'll keep my testimony short because I know you have other bills. But again, we strongly urge you to reject this bill.
Okay. Thank you. And questions? Representative Lynn.
Thank you for coming in today. Could you give an example of the type of case in which you might get involved in suing the state as a public interest, they would involve sexual assault and domestic violence and those type of activities?
Right, that's a great question. I can talk about our litigation that happened back in 1997. The court system refused to put all three types of protective orders on the state court form, so a victim could not request all forms of relief that the legislature had mandated by statute. We tried for over a year to negotiate with the court system, and we finally had to file suit. We were very lucky to get an attorney because we couldn't do it all in-house. Taking on the state of Alaska court system is pretty daunting, and as a new attorney, that was a big thing. So we hired outside counsel, and basically, you know, we were suing for the right to have all forms of relief that had been mandated by the legislature, and we were successful. We had an attorney who, at reduced fees, took on that case. Our attorney fees were very minimal, though, because we tried in-house to keep that cost down as a nonprofit. So that's one example. If we had not filed that litigation, I do not believe victims would have all three types of protective orders available to them on the court forms today.
And can I just interrupt for one question? And that is, when it came up for your attorney fees to be reimbursed, now, did you put in for the attorney fees as they had been in incurred at the reduced levels and all, or were those taken up to and requested at a higher level?
No, we requested those fees at the level that we incurred them, which was at a reduced rate. So our fees for that, it was at least a year-long litigation, was $19,000.
So again, it was the actual attorney fees.
It was,
and the court
correct.
Decided that those were reasonable and gave you the actual attorney fees.
Right. So what we had expended throughout the litigation, and it was a great hardship that we expended those fees. We have very limited unrestricted funding. Most of our funding is for specific grant activities. And so it was a hardship even for us to come up with, you know, reduced fees. So thank litigation, you know, such as this would really limit our ability.
Thank you. And Representative Lynn.
Yes, in this litigation that you had, were there several different elements of that litigation? And did you prevail on all the, if so, did you prevail on all those elements of the litigation or just some?
That's a great question. There were three different elements in our case, and we prevailed on two of them. Two of them became moot. The court system agreed on two of the issues throughout the litigation to simply make the change on the court forms. But the third issue, which was our primary issue, was not allowing three types of separate, you know, forms of protective orders on the court form. That one, they would not, we won on that through litigation. Mm-hmm. So two of the issues became mute, but we won on all three points. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you. Representative Gruenberg.
Ms. Robinson, in several cases, we've learned in the legislature that the NRA has sued to protect Second Amendment rights, the right to bear arms. Would they qualify as a public interest litigant on something like that?
Well, that's a good question. You know, there are a number of factors the court looks at in determining whether or not you're a public interest litigant. It's not necessarily, it's not simply by the issue that you're bringing to the court. You know, I can tell you the factors are, is the case designed to affect strong public policies? If the plaintiff succeeds, will numerous people receive benefits from the lawsuit? Can only a private party have been expected to bring the suit? Would the purported public interest litigant have sufficient economic incentive to file suit, even if the action involved only narrow issues lacking general importance? So the court is going to look at all four of those factors to determine whether or not you qualify as a public interest litigant. So they may very well qualify if they meet those factors.
Thank you very much.
I guess, and this comes back to, and you're probably not the person to ask, but we also had testimony that a court may also determine that apportionment is appropriate because the litigant raised certain issues that were frivolous, and that's Danisau versus Ulmer. in 98. Were you familiar with that, or was that occurring at the same time your suit was going? I mean, of course, obviously, since you went on all your points, none of them were considered frivolous, but were you made aware of any of those things as far as a public interest litigant suit, if you filed more issues and some of those were determined frivolous, that could reduce the award?
You know, I'm not familiar with that case, and so I can't really comment.
That's fine. The AG will be coming back up, and we'll ask them about that.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Did anyone else have any other questions? Really appreciate you coming in. And
thanks
for your work in sexual assault and domestic violence. We've been involved in that and other laws on that very much recently, so appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Is there anyone else online to testify on this bill? Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 86? Seeing none, I will close the public testimony, and I'd ask the Attorney General's office to come back up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll wrap up pretty quickly. Just a couple of things I wanted to clarify. One is that Representative Gatto made the comment about the public interest litigant doctrine being an aberration among the 50 states. It is an aberration. And the other states that do provide recovery of enhanced attorney's fees do handle that by statute. And we're suggesting that this legislature can do that very same thing. The other thing I wanted to note is that the apportionment issue, public interest litigants under Dan Sereau can prevail on one issue, one item, and recover full attorney's fees for if they brought 14 claims, they prevailed even on getting something as minor as a TRO and lost on everything else. I think the court would, under Dan Sereau, can give them full fees. And the case with the TRO is a recent one. That's Halloran v. State. The public interest litigant in that case received a TRO, and then I think there was quite a bit more litigation, and the court awarded him full fees for everything simply because he prevailed on the TRO issue. So the apportionment's important under the PIL doctrine to understand that they can only need only prevail on one small issue, and they get paid.
And would you detail that for us in writing, because that's in a direct opposition to some of the other written material that we
have. It's the Dan Sereau case.
Yeah, Dan Sereau versus Ulmer,
right.
98.
Right.
And would you outline that for us?
Sure.
In writing.
Yeah, I can do that. I can cite the cases and get that to you. Mr. McLeod Ball mentioned that you need to have something in place that imposes a penalty on parties for bringing a frivolous suit or a losing suit even, and under the public interest litigant doctrine, even if they lose, they don't pay anything. There was also some characterization of the types of plaintiffs that bring these cases as being, the ordinary everyday person, an individual with a lack of funds, and while that may be the case in some instances, I think if you look at Ms. Taylor's February 17th legislative report, I think to your office, most of the entities listed in there are organizations, environmental groups, ACLU, and I would suggest to you that there some of those organizations at least have more than ample funds don't require don't fit the image that was painted for the public interest litigants. The eminent domain, Mr. McBall mentioned eminent domain as an exception. That's in current statute, and that's why it would still stand. And that just points out that the legislature should have the authority to decide when and where exceptions should lie. And I guess I have to make one final comment. The one attorney that testified, I think, from Anchorage was kind of, I think, characterizing the Department of Law as not being very competent. And I'd just like to say I highly disagree with that. I've worked in private practice for 8 years, and I work next to and with the attorneys at the Department of Law. And a lot of them are in sections. They gain a lot of experience in a particular area, and I think they're actually very, very competent attorneys.
Chair. And one thing we pointed out, public testimony is public testimony and opinions, and they can be.
Sure.
Those are not necessarily the opinions that are held by the committee, even if they're not challenged by the committee. I had one other question, and that was that we had some testimony that said that challenging on constitutional grounds, there would be full attorney fees anyway, and I don't see that in this legislation. Is that?
Mr. Chairman, that exception is in the bill HB 145 that's up on appeal right now.
And that exception, is that for the recovery or the payment of fees?
It's for the recovery, I believe. So a prevailing.
So, but we're passing a piece of subsequent legislation now without the exception for enhanced recovery fees for constitutional grounds. So as I see it, this subsequent legislation will be precedent over previous legislation. Is that correct?
I believe that's incorrect, Mr. Chairman. If you look at page 2, lines 4 through 6, it states that the Act does not preclude or repeal statutes in effect that authorize enhanced attorney fee awards.
Okay.
So that it dovetails in that regard.
Okay, thank you. And we'll look at that. We have a question from Representative Gardner.
Thank you. You talked about the Dan Searle case in which the plaintiff lost on 14 points and got attorney fees for winning on one.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I believe it was 11 counts that were brought and they prevailed on one. I'd have to look at the case to see the exact number.
And Representative Gardner, you're going to go ahead and give us an analysis of the Dan Searle versus Ulmer case.
Right. Is that standard, or are there other cases in which the plaintiff wins only part and gets partial award of attorney fees?
I guess I'm not clear on your question, Representative Gardner,
okay.
Through the chair.
Representative Gardner.
Chair, in the example that you gave, there were, say, 11 points. Mm-hmm. The plaintiff wins on one of the points and gets full attorney fees. Is that standard? Are there other cases in which somebody could have 11 points, win on one point, and get partial fees? What's the most customary?
But through the chair, Representative Gardner, the standard for non-public interest litigants is that they have to be the prevailing party on the main issue in the case. So that's the standard for non-public interest litigants. For public interest litigants, they merely need to prevail on a issue in the case to receive payment of full attorney's fees for all issues.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any other questions for the Attorney General? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that the Attorney General's office has competence, right?
Oh, I very much believe they do.
And they specialize in the kinds of cases they're defending, right?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, what I was trying to convey is that some of the attorneys are able to gain a lot of experience in one area of law.
So they're often even more competent than the little litigant who's up against them, right?
I don't know that I could make that. I mean, I guess that would be a case-by-case instance.
Well, and certainly the state of Alaska has far more resources than any litigant that they're up against, right?
Well, the state as an entity has a significant amount of resources. That's correct.
So they've got very competent attorneys and unlimited resources.
Through the chair, Representative Gruner, I wouldn't label it as unlimited.
Representative Gruner, I don't want to get into this.
That's all I have to
say. We did have one other person that was already signed up in Anchorage before we closed public testimony, but we didn't have it on our record here. So we're going to go back to reopen public testimony and go back to Anchorage. Kay Rollinson, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Would you go ahead, identify yourself, and proceed with your testimony?
Yes, sir. I really appreciate the chance to speak. I guess we were all having technical difficulty here. My name is Kay Rollison. I live in Anchorage, Alaska. I am self-employed. I represent myself in this testimony. I would be a true public litigant. I guess I just have a little analogy that is personal to me that has impacted my life greatly in Alaska. Many years ago, I had a case that I had to take on, and luckily I found a couple of attorneys that were willing to take it on contingency fee. And, you know, it was against organized labor. And needless to say, that was a deep pocket, and issues were such that if it had not been for the loser pays requirement, you know, I'd have never been able to take that case on. And was successful in pieces, and I won't get into the legal part of it, but the Mr. McLeod Ball, I mean, I'm here in Anchorage, so I heard his testimony, and it was excellent. I am and would be a public, I would be a public litigant. I do believe that our state government, U.S. government, that my right to bring a case against, you know, one of you sitting there, or the governor, or anybody else that I feel is not fulfilling their obligation under the law, my just knowing that I can do that keeps me in the process. You know, my vote, one man, one vote, one woman, one vote, that only goes so far. But once somebody's in office, if I can't come within the judicial system, that branch of our government, and know that I have a way to at least, even if I'm risking everything I've got, to bring it to court, if I'm willing to risk that, knowing that if I lose, I pay, that still gives me some way to stay in the system. If you take this bill to conclusion, you know, what's to keep it from sliding over into the private sector also so that those same contingency fees would be, you know, limited to a certain amount? And then I'd have no way to defend myself in that arena either. But when it comes to principle, when it comes to integrity, and it comes to my staying connected to how we run this state, if you pass this bill, you've just cut my legs right out from under me. I personally right now have concerns with things that are going on in our legislature, things that are going on in our government, and I may well be one of those public litigants. And with respect to your nonprofits and how they play into it, okay, I'm single, I'm by myself, you know, I have some small savings, but if I had a case, if I had something that I just was willing to risk everything for, I would probably have to go around and look for some nonprofit that might be interested in taking me, you know, taking my case, being willing to help me, because at least they have possible other supporters or some way of helping me present that case. But my plea to you is to please keep this process as it is. It's scary even as it is. But I just think it's incredibly untimely that this particular piece of legislation is brought up. You might be thinking that you're defending yourself or looking out for some big money bag nonprofit group from outside the state or even inside the state, but I'm not one of those, and I've used this process at least on the private side, and I may well use it on the public side.
Thank you, Ms. Rollinson. We're going to have to go. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you very much.
And thanks again. And now we'll reclose public testimony, and we have some issues that will be briefed for us and will be coming back for us. We'll set SB 86 aside. We have just a few minutes. We have House Bill 461 up, and I want to open that for a moment because we have a CS, and so if we can adopt that CS as a working document, at least we'll
what have it. This?
This is House Bill 461, and at least everybody will be on the same page and then can we'll know where to comment. Yes, Representative Elkins.
I would move CS for House Bill number 461 / Y for a hearing.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. So we have before us 461 version Y, and Representative Gardner, you want to make just a very brief comment on this?
And very, very quickly, I'd like to say first, thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this again. I think my aide, Iris Matthews, is online, and if she can be free to speak up if I'm missing something, I'd appreciate that. Dan Wayne, the bill's drafter, may be online. Is that true? Brooke Miles from APOC and Tammy Kemp here in the audience. There were some questions raised on the initial bill, and I think that the substitute here has addressed them. One question was personal services, and we had some confusion about what that really meant. That's the language of existing law. Personal services, it turns out, are defined as not only consulting or contract kind of work, but also employment. So if you're a legislator and you're employed by somebody such that you get a W-2, that employment would also have to be described under this bill. It previously had to be disclosed, but now we have to say what it is.
And Representative Gardner, I think that was one of the main issues that we talked about the other day.
Right.
Have you, I don't think that was the intent of your bill.
No, that wasn't the intent of my bill, but it was one of the questions.
Have you been able to work out that issue yet?
Yes.
Okay.
The existing language using personal services meets my desire as well as APOC's understanding of what the intent is, which is that all income should be disclosed with some description, not just consulting or contracting. It needs to be a little broader. So if you're an employee, you disclose it. If the income comes as a result of work for which you are licensed, for example, if you're a pilot or a hairdresser, and there are specific elements in our current legislation that defines licensee, then that could be enough description in and of itself. If you're an attorney, for example, you do legal services, you don't have to go into detail about exactly what your legal services were. If you are a licensed attorney and the income comes as a result, you do under terms of your licensing. And then one of the other questions that came up was whether you have to say how many hours you intend to work. And initially, my understanding was APOC had a problem with that because they're concerned about what has actually happened. You're reporting what's happened. My concern is that you can have income for work you're going to do over a course of time, some of which you've already done and some of which maybe you haven't. And I think that APOC is now comfortable with retaining language, which you'll see on page 2, line 11, the approximate total number of hours that have been spent or will be spent reporting, performing the services. The chair had questions about dividend income and wanted that to be included, and you'll see on page 2, line 4, the language as to a dividend received from a limited liability company as compensation for personal services. So you have to sort of disclose and describe that. And then the other change we made is on page 2, lines 14 through 18. There was language in existing statute that we didn't fully understand, and talking with APOC, they sort of agreed that it wasn't terribly meaningful. The source of income is known or reasonably should be known to have a substantial interest in legislative, administrative, or political action. And I think that when you accept money as a legislator, you don't always know whether the source of that money may, during the time of your service, come before the legislature in any way. So that's kind of like, I think, poorly worded. And this committee substitute removes that part. So you simply describe the amount of income received from the source without regard to whether or not you expect any legislation to come before you relating to the source of that income. You don't have to make that judgment call. You simply disclose it and describe it.
And Representative Gardner, have the issue that we brought up about the personal services includes employment?
Yes.
We resolved that?
That's the current definitions, and it's recognized and understood under the legislation and according to APOC, and maybe they would want to weigh in here.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Questions at this time? Brooke Miles, are you online?
Mr. Chairman, I am.
Hi. Thank you, Ms. Miles. Would you go ahead and identify yourself for the record?
Most certainly, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brooke Miles, and I am the Executive Director for the Alaska Public Offices Commission.
Okay, and Brooke, the question was, it came up at the last hearing, and that was that we were looking at this also requiring for everybody that's just a standard employee anywhere, personal services were involved as well as employment. Is that still the case, or have we worked out?
Mr. Chairman, that is the case. Personal services would include employees of a company, regular employees of a company, or people who receive compensation on a contractual basis. However, in discussions with Representative Gardner's staff, we were set at ease with respect to that certainly if necessary, because the job title isn't descriptive enough, a person who's a regular employee would have the option of attaching their job description, which would, of course, fully describe it. Mr. Chairman, as you recall, APOC's primary concern with the legislation was that we may not, in the previous version, have had a bright enough line about who would be required to provide some additional description outside of just I'm a fisherman, right, or I'm an attorney. And I think that with Representative Gardner's staff working with us through this, we are feeling much more comfortable about it. And I would like to weigh in, Mr. Chairman, if I could, and a particular appreciation for getting rid of the language that required those who received more than $5,000 to report also the amount, and that's only for the legislator or legislative director, not for a legislator's spouse or dependent child who may be living with them. And by removing the language concerning if the source of income is known or reasonably should be known to have a substantial interest in legislative, administrative, or political action, that being that it was somewhat difficult for APOC staff, we didn't make a judgment on that, but left it to the public and the reader to determine that if somebody, because it was so subjective, if a person indicated that that they had more than $5,000 of employment but didn't show the amount, our only really clear guideline to request an audit was if we knew the company retained a lobbyist, because, of course, the lobbying was within our purview as well. So I think that subjective language was confusing both to the filer and to the public, and if the intent is that legislators are held to this higher level of disclosure in that their personal services that are more than $5,000, they also disclose the amount, how much simpler to just have that stated plainly in law. I really appreciate it.
Okay, and so from APOC standpoint, you don't see any further problems with the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're not seeing further problems with the bill at this point, and I would also like for the committee's knowledge to state that once a CS of this nature is read across the floor, we would be revising our fiscal note to a zero fiscal note.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Is there any further comment on the bill? Do we have a motion?
I'll move the bill with individual recommendations.
We have a motion to move the bill with individual recommendations, attached fiscal note. Is there objection? Seeing no objection, the bill will move with individual recommendations, attached fiscal note. And we are adjourned for the day, and we're